Okay. It is. Oh yeah, that's when it's voice activated.
Yeah.
But you can actually switch that off. That's not on the voice activation, just the lights go on. It doesn't stop in between, it just goes on. Today is the 7th of June, and anything you can say can be held against you. And the reason I want to use this for, if I get your permission, would be if I get down to writing this book on Native literature in Canada today. And I've got interviews with a lot of people. And before it's, whenever I get it transcribed or so, before I do anything with it, you'll get a copy and to, for approval. And then we'll have to talk about whether I can use it or what I can use and so on. Okay?
Yeah.
And maybe, yeah?
Yeah.
May I take this?
Sure. Maybe you could explain. You see, I want to use this for people who get to Native literature to begin with, to get, give them an overview. So maybe you could have that in mind and explain how you got to be a storyteller. Or is that too long a story?
No, well, no? There's a story behind that.
Sure.
Because I think I had it in me, mm-hmm, long ago, you know, that I was a storyteller. Because during the American Indian Movement days, they used to go around sometimes to go out and have some political speeches. And whenever it was my turn to give those political speeches, I always tell a story. I always begin with a story. And that was way back. Back then, and now we come down to today here in the city of Regina, we've got a reputation as a Native storyteller. But the way that came about was my wife. She was working at Kennard School, and she had organized a Native girls dancers. And I used to help her to go out to different schools with these girls to perform,
mm-hmm,
these dances. And it is one day. One day we went to the school to do dancing, and we were supposed to have a drum group. And the drum group was late, and the whole school was in the gym, and the kids were just acting up, and we were anxiously waiting for they were half an hour late. So I told Sue, I'll go up and I'll tell the story. He said, okay. So I went to the mic and I told the story. I told that one story there, and ever since then I've been telling stories to schools all over Regina. Besides, my father is a storyteller,
mm-hmm,
and my mother is a storyteller. I think that's where my storytelling comes from.
And the stories you tell, are they stories that you learned from your parents and elders, or do you swap stories with other storytellers?
Yes. I heard some stories from my mom. Heard some stories from my dad, heard some stories from other elders in my area, and I heard some from different parts of the country, all the way from South Dakota down to Iroquois Confederacy, all the way down to Navajo country, into all over Canada, United States. Wherever I lived with Indian people, I sit down and listen to these people tell stories.
You've also published a story in that book, Achimuna.
Yeah, that story that I published in the book Achimuna is fiction.
Mm-hmm.
It's not anything that I heard anywhere. It's just, I just wrote it. fiction too is different. There's two of them. There's mm-hmm. two different ones.
Maybe you can go into this sort of difference between the oral tradition, and then if you write fiction, how does that connect, or does it not connect? Is that totally separate?
Well, to me, it's different because oral tradition, it's stories that you pass down from generation to generation. That's, you know, and fiction. Fiction comes out of somewhere inside a person, inside a writer.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know where the story fiction comes out from,
mm-hmm.
because at a moment there's a story that I'm working on, and it's an old ancient story, and it's not anything that I have heard from my people or from mm-hmm. other people all over other mm-hmm. other places. Yes. And the way these Indian people live in the fiction is different,
mm-hmm.
entirely different oh, yeah. from history books or other. It's different.
How do you feel about parts from the oral tradition being written down and published?
It's good.
You think it's cool?
Yeah, I don't think there's anything lost.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there's anything lost. Because in today's society we're living in a world that's, you know, people live by books. You know, they read fiction and they read nonfiction, and there's lots of how to books, you know, how to live books. You know, people live by books these days.
Yeah. So would you see the oral tradition as an how to book too?
Well, I don't think. No, I don't think oral tradition is a how to book.
I was kidding. But what I've read and heard about the oral tradition, so it's mainly telling people who they are, where they come from and where they're headed, and who the others are. Isn't that what it's very often about, so that people know who they are, their place here?
Yeah, I guess.
And so if it's also tells them who they are, then they know where they're going. So it's how to survive, how to be a person.
I guess it's something like that, because I just came back from Fort McMurray.
Mm-hmm.
I spent a month and a half in Fort McMurray, and one day I was just talking, just a couple of boys talking from my hometown, Fort Chipewyan, and I said it was really nice this morning. 4 o'clock this morning, it was really nice. 5 o'clock this morning, really beautiful. So I went out. I went for a little walk this morning. So it was just beautiful. And then one of them guys just said, "Yeah," he said, "it's really nice in the morning." He said, "Long time ago," he said, "in Fort Chipewyan," he said, "these people, they live across the street from you," he told me. This young man, he said, he was about 10 or 12, 13 years old that time. He said, this young man, he said, he went for a walk in the morning. He said, around his house, he went for a walk in the morning. And he looked on a ground there. There's patch of grass on the ground there. All of a sudden, that patch of grass opened. And a little man came out. And he looked at it, he said. He didn't know what it was. He looked at it, and he started going toward it. That little man jumped back inside that hole, and the grass went back there. So he went to that patch of grass. He tried to open it. Couldn't do it. It was all part of the ground. But he said, he's seen it. He said, years later, he said, it's years later, he's talking about 3 or 4 years ago. Years later, he went back to Fort Chip, and he went back to the patch of grass and trying to figure out how that patch of grass opened and little man come out.
Mm-hmm.
See, that's a story right there. Today's story. It's not talking about 100 years ago.
Mm-hmm. We have a lot of stories about little people too.
Let's talk about that's really surprised me, you know, to hear, because these people are really working people, really redneck people. They're Indians, but they're hard-working redneck Indians, you know. And I didn't know they were like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, there's lots of little people's stories about. There's one I think I told, so sometimes I can't tell it because in a way I think it's very sad and I start crying, but try not to. This was very long ago. Where I come from, there's this river called the Eider, and the Eider sort of divides...
Germany?
This is in Germany, yeah, and it divides, say, Scandinavia from Germany. And the north on the Eider was Danish, or people spoke German and Danish and Frisian, various languages. The south, there were Saxon tribes people, Holstens and Dithmarsians, and then there were Slavonic tribes further to the east. But the Eider was sort of a dividing line between cultures for a long time, but it was also a meeting place. And I was born on this little island in that river called Rendsburg. But this was before I think Rendsburg existed, or maybe it was just a little village. It was further to a little downriver. There was this ferryman, and he lived in this house. I think it would be like wooden posts and then wattles in between and clay, and for windows they'd have like pigskin so that the light would come in, and it's the thatched roof, and he had this little cabin there. And he had his boat, flat boat, on the river. And when people wanted to cross, he could take them over in his ferry. And he was sleeping this night. And when he heard this noise, like a little rattling noise, as if somebody had taken some sand, thrown that against his window pane, he didn't see anything. So, oh, that's weird. You know, he went back to sleep, and this happened again. And it happened. He went back to sleep again. Then it happened a third time. And then, then he got up and he opened the door and looked outside and didn't see anything. He was just about to go back to sleep when he heard this little voice and say, down here. And he looked, and sure enough, when his eyes had got used to the dark, he saw all these lights, and there were these tiny people, really small. And they had everything. They had horses and wagons and oxen, and they had little tiny lanterns. They were all ready. They were all packed. And they had old ones and little ones. They were all there. And as far as he could see, I guess this was looking towards the south. I think he was on the south side, but I'm not sure. And as far as he could see, it was like a sort of shining snake all the way back to the horizon. That's how many little people there were. And they were all ready to move and leave. And this one of the little people, told him, we want to get across the river. And he said, well, I can't get you all over there. I mean, I've just got this boat, and there's so many of you. He said, don't you worry. You'll manage. You've got to do it tonight. And he was tired. He wasn't really willing, but then he thought, I've got to help these people out. And he said, and he lived by this, so he said, how are you going to pay me? He said, don't you worry. You just put down your cap or your hat. It'll be warm anyway, and we'll pay you. So he took off his cap or his hat and he put it down on the ground, and then he got to his boat. And there they were already lined up to get in there, and he got some boards and they moved the wagons, everything. So he had hundreds of people in one go taking them over. And all night he went back and forth, and whenever he had one bunch of people over there and they were sort of trailing off into the distance there, he went back and got the next load. He thought he'd never get done, but he did. And when there's the first light in the east, that's when he saw sort of the last lights flickering, disappearing in the moors. That's marsh country up in the north. And then he went back to his cabin, and he was looking for the pavement. And there was this light shining in his cap. So it was, they paid him tiny, tiny pieces of gold, and this was reflecting the first sunlight. But the people never came back. That really makes me sad. We get a lot of stories like that. There's stories. But there are other stories, actually. Some of the people must have survived because there are other characters called Niels Puk. That's one, just one name. Those would be little people, maybe just one guy or a little family that attached themselves to one farm, and the farmers would feed them. When they put out milk for the cats, they'd have an extra bowl for Niels Puk and some cereal. And if you for generations, they would, these little people never aged, so generations would look after them. And but if you did something wrong or you laughed about them, if they did something funny, fell down some steps, if you laughed, they really got cross. And then at least for three generations, people would have really tough luck. So, but there are lots of stories like that. So, what's my story? There are also stories about, I think I told you about the giants. They weren't just giants, they weren't just, they weren't just the little people, but the giants too. And I think their stories are more political, because they're stories about these big rocks that you find from the Ice Age. That's what geologists say, but people say those were thrown by the giants. You know what they were throwing at? Church towers. You know why? They couldn't stand the ringing of the bells. So, but they left too, you know. But I like that idea.
There's a giant up north too.
There's a giant beaver up north.
And a giant. We saw his pipe.
Yeah.
The stem was this thick. The bowl was like this. The main.
There's lots of sacred places up north that nobody knows about except the old people. Down south, around here and all over the United States, people, they know where sacred places are because they're living right in the middle of civilized country, yeah? Civilization, people all over the place. Books and books are written about them. But the Dene up there north, Nobody knows about it. There's no books written about Dene. There's no anthropologists or sociologists went up there to write about books about Dene. We don't want them to do that. I don't want them to do that anyways. Nobody knows the Dene better than the Dene, and I'm a Dene. Except for Smokery Boys.
How important is language for the oral tradition? Does the oral tradition lose if you speak it in English?
Does I don't think so.
No?
I don't think so because I know a few stories that are heard in Dene that I tell in English. And I think I do it pretty good. I do it well. I don't think it loses from one language to the other. Mm-hmm. Not for me, anyways.
Mm-hmm. Are you is Dene your first language?
Yeah.
And do you make a distinction when you tell stories? Which stories you tell whom?
No. Have you read that there is and people, and there's also they also say Indian people tell stories only a certain time.
Only
a certain time of the
year.
Yeah,
I heard that.
But
not with you. No, you told me.
No, it wasn't. Not the way I grew up. I grew up tradition.
Yeah.
One language, and we live in traditional way. We never lost our language. We never lost our traditional way of living. Even today, we are people that live. We still live traditionally. So you can't say we tell stories any time that we lost anything. You know, us Dene, we just
maybe different in other cultures, though. Huh?
Yeah. And even like when I first went out, travel around all over Canada and United States. I heard about the clans.
Mm-hmm.
You know. And to this day, I don't know what a clan is, because when I went home, I tried to explain to my mom and dad, my grandfather and my grandmother, clan. There's no word in my language for a clan.
No. But there's a word for family, huh?
Yeah, there's a word for family, but there's no word for clan. I don't know what a clan is.
Dene means people?
Yeah. Dene means people, but we call ourselves Dene Somtene. That's what we call ourselves. We're called the only people. We're the only people. So I'm a Dene Somtene. I'm the only Indian.
You say that only because of land claims.
I don't have to bother with land claims.
No, I was just kidding. You say I'm the only one. That's what a lot of people say when it comes to claims.
Yeah. So if I want to bother with land claims, the government's got to claim our land. I don't have to claim my land.
So for how long have you been working as a storyteller?
Oh boy.
How long ago was that, this incident at the school?
Here in Regina, about 6 years.
More than that, about eight? No, you're right. I went there in 83, 84, 6 years.
About 6 years, son. 6 years. And I really don't know that many stories either. It's just a few ones. And there's lots more from back in my area.
So, do you travel back there to learn more stories?
Or
you just go there and you hear them?
Yeah, I just go within. I hear stories. They say. I think I've heard people say you could buy stories. Have you ever heard that?
Yeah.
I think I've heard there's something about that. You buy stories. I've never done that, but I've been thinking about that in the last maybe 2-3 years. Going to give for a story.
If somebody tells you a story, do you? What do you give to the person who tells the story? Another story, or?
Yeah, we just sit there exchanging stories. But sometimes people just sit on and just tell a story. And if I really like that story, I grab it.
Do you tell that person, I like your story, yeah. And I'm going to tell it?
No, I never do that because at that time when I used to do that, I used to think well I'm not really a storyteller. I just like the story, you know.
Okay.
Like the story. Now I'm becoming a storyteller. I may have to think about that.
Also, you think about copyright.
I've never really came across copyright before either.
No, but I thought the definition that we heard the other day, and that is also in the book, based on trust, that what Alec Wolf said, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. I've never really thought of that before.
And the way I understood it, it wasn't an exclusive copyright that you're not used, but that you're not allowed to use anything that you've heard, but the main thing apparently is the acknowledgement and the agreement of that person. That's the way I understood it.
I got lost there.
No, what he said was, that's the way I understood him, that the copyright system, the first thing is you always acknowledge the sources and tell you who has told you the story, where you got it from, if somebody sort of has used it first, so you acknowledge that.
If you do that,
then you're not actually stealing it because you're acknowledging the person who holds that story.
Yeah, like that story I told at lunch.
Oh yeah, you told.
My dad told me that story.
Yeah, you acknowledged your dad, and then.
Just your whole story. You did it.
Hello.
Good to see you again.
That worked. We're
another week.
So when you travel around now, is that with with the wish in mind or so to get more stories?
No. When at that time, when I was traveling around, I didn't. The idea of getting stories was far from my. From now, maybe mm-hmm. go around now. Mm-hmm. Now I. Mm-hmm. Will, think about stories. People telling stories, like that little story I told about that little people come out of that. Ever since I first heard it, you know, it was bothering me. I wanted to tell that story too. I wanted to tell you that story too, because it amazed me. That story mm-hmm. really amazed me because I was just an ordinary person. Mm-hmm. He doesn't even know much his language, and yet he's seen that. He must have been blessed. With something, that person. I never seen him, but he must have been blessed with something, that person, to see something like that when he was a young man. And it's still bothering him today because he went back there to see if it really happened.
Sure.
That's what your granny said, that all those things live under the earth.
Yeah.
She said all those things that people see, like those, like people talk about big serpents and big trouts and the Loch Ness monster and little people and all those things. She says they all live under the earth.
That's true.
There's streams under the earth and people live under there, she said, and when the end time comes, then they're all going to come out.
That's what you asked me about runes. Well, that's what the runes say. That's what the sort of Nordic mythology says. That some of the beings, that there was this one Loki who went wrong. He was one of the first gods, really, who created things, but he turned pretty evil and created all kinds of beings that are dangerous. And the other gods had those beings pretty much under control. One was a giant wolf, Fenris, who would attack all the time. And when they tied him down, I think I told you that story. Tua, he was the god of war. So Fenris was very smart, and he said, you can't tie me down. And he said, well, show how strong you are. And they brought these chains, and you just go crack them. So they went to this one dwarf, or little person, who was a smith who could weave rams and all kinds, and he made these strings that were almost like silk, very soft and easy looking, and they were unbreakable. And they said, well, you can tear this up. So they gave it to him. He said, I don't trust you guys. So you can tie me with that, but one of you has got to put his arm into my mouth as you do it. And then they were kind of silent, you know, because nobody wanted to risk his arm. They knew that he wouldn't be able to break loose. And then Tua, who is, some say he's the god of war. He was a very honest, upstanding guy, I guess. And he took, because he knew it was necessary for the survival of the people. So he put his arm in there. I think it was his right, actually. His sword hand. And he bit it off. And the other one is the Midgard snake. Midgard is the middle yard. There's Asgard, that is the area where the gods live. Then there's the middle yard, that is where we live. And then there's, I forgot the name, the other yard. That's the underworld. And the Midgard snake is this big snake also created by Loki. Who attacks things in the water, and she's so big she can actually lie around the whole of the earth and bite her own tail at the end. That's how powerful she is. And there were various encounters between her and human beings in boats and the gods too. Tua, I told you about, he once had an encounter with her, and he actually hooked her and was going to strike her with his hammer and kill her. And I said she, because the German word Schlange, snake, is female by gender, but it doesn't mean that this is a female being. So it, I should say. Anyway, he was going to kill it, and he had tied it up, but he was in a boat with some giants, and one of the giants cut the thread. So Midgard got away, and they knew that the gods know that on that final day, There's going to be a terrible battle between people in Asgard and those friends of Loki, and it'll destroy the world, but there will be a new world afterwards. And the first one of the first things is there will be neither. There are lots of stories like that, and of course Christianity tried to kill it all, but they didn't. Anyway, here I am telling stories.
Well, you're a storyteller too, huh?
I don't know. I only realized recently that it's important to know these stories for children and also for other people who will listen.
Yeah? What I don't understand is what happened. Like, the whole world was Aboriginal cultures, and there was all kinds of stories that were real parallel and everything.
Yeah, yeah.
And all of a sudden, what happened? What happened to the white world? Where did those stories go? What happened?
That's the question. I've really been pondering for 10 years or more.
My
answers, but not the answer.
My theory is the Industrial Revolution happened.
I think it was earlier than that.
It was earlier.
I think it has to do also with Christianity and the Roman Empire. I think sometimes I thought maybe it turned. You know, there was one Roman emperor pretty late in Roman times, maybe I think 200 or 300 after Christ,
mm-hmm.
who in the beginning the Christians in Rome, they were persecuted and they lived in the underworld, so to speak, catacombs. But then he had this dream and he saw a cross and it said, "In hoc signo vinces, you'll be victorious if you use this sign." And he was facing a big battle. And what they had originally, the Roman legionaries, they had eagle staff, or they had staffs or with metal eagles on top, and then flags or signs that were their emblems. And he superimposed, instead of the eagles, he used the cross. And that is the first combination, historically, where sort of Christianity gives up the thought of love thy neighbor and don't kill, but sort of unites church power with spiritual power with earthly power. It's really ruthless, because from then on, people always thought they had God on their side and they did the most atrocious things. I always thought that was the beginning, and then I read this book, somebody who went into the Old Testament and Jewish tradition, and if you read the Old Testament again, I haven't read it, is all about one tribe conquering the other tribe,
mm-hmm.
and they fall on their knees and thank them if they had put 2,000 to the sword. So it's even older than Christianity. But it comes from the Near East, spread all over, and I'm sure that, I know that in my region it was the monks and the Christianity that destroyed the old religion.
Well, that's what got rid of runes. That's when the runes went underground.
That's right, yeah.
Because I was given a whole...
Where did you get them?
The psychic gave me beautiful amethyst runes in a book, and I've never been able to get around to them. That's why I was starting to ask you about them. And they're beautiful, and there's power in them, and that's the one
just
thing.
Just these signs, right?
Well, on amethyst stones. And
that's
and,
not runes. Runes are like an alphabet. There's
yeah, it is an alphabet,
okay.
But they're carved in these amethyst stones.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And there's a book with it, and that's what I got out of the book. Like, I didn't have time to. It said do one chapter a month, and with my schedule, I can't do that.
No.
But the one thing it did say was runes were used very frequently with the Saxon tribes. And,
yeah.
and then when Christianity came, it all went underground. And they said even Hitler used runes to make some of his decisions.
I don't know whether he did that, but he was much intrigued by it.
And they said and that scared people even more.
That's
the
true.
Aftermath of knowing that Hitler used them, that they really didn't
Well, that's
use
destroyed
them.
A lot. Because if you know... go into those things, immediately you get under the suspicion that you are a Nazi or something. So I keep a very, very low profile on that. I'm very cautious.
What's Nazi? Is that German word?
That's a subtraction from Nationalsozialist, National Socialist.
Oh,
no, he did the really... almost genial and stupid at the same time, decision of combining two opposing, really opposing political thought. One's a socialism, and socialism in itself is internationalist, right? But he also combined it with nationalism and said we need a national socialism. And that intrigued people, so he could get the real right-winger, the real strong nationalists and military. Yeah. And he got the leftists too,
yeah,
socialism. No. So he brought it, two things that don't really go together at all in philosophy. He brought them together.
Did you know in the Hopi prophecies, they said the world was going to get shook up three times? And the first time was that swastika sign. It was like they knew.
Yeah. I know about David Menendez. He was over in Europe looking for swastikas. It was so embarrassing. I know the guy he was staying with in Heidelberg said, I'm going down the road with this little guy. And he says, where are the swastikas? You're not allowed to display one in Germany. So we really had a laugh because he thought he would go find it straight away. And I once saw Thomas Benyaka show this skin with the signs.
Mm-hmm.
And he said he hesitates very much to show it because of the swastika on there. And certainly for me, it's a sign that freaks me. Or
yeah, except that in their context, it's not a freak. I mean, it was prophesied centuries before that this was going to be a shake-up of the world.
Yeah.
And it just proves how right on the prophecies were.
Even
the swastika is much older than even in Germany, it's much older. It's a sun symbol. It's the wheels of... You know, the sun is a big disc. That's what in the old belief, and it's on this wagon. It's got four wheels, and it's drawn by a horse. And there's the sun god, and actually the priest did that too once at midsummer. They transported this big disc so that people could see it, and the wheels of that wagon. If you make the swastika round on the side, that's like a wagon wheel. That's where it comes from. That's what people say.
Oh yeah, it wasn't a bad sign, but he's turned it into something important.
Sure. Well, a lot of our culture has really been spoiled because of that. And it's taken some of the roots away. You know what I once liked and that made a lot of sense to me, and I thought about that? About literature here in Canada, white literature and other. It was Maria Campbell who said that. She thought that white people in Canada, most of them had lost their mother. And on many, she was thinking of a mother on a father voice or so.
Oh, okay.
And, but also the mother in terms of the land.
Mm,
I think it's true. And Wood and I, we've discussed that so long. Some of the people, they believe there are no roots. Well, they don't have roots here, maybe. And that explains a lot, I think. It's true, they've lost the mother.
Even our kids, they're away from their roots, where their relations, where come from, where I just came from. All my relatives, they all live together.
Mm-hmm.
They all got different lives. Every single one, they got different lives. And yet, there's a closeness to all the people.
Mm-hmm.
My kids don't have that.
Yeah.
And those my family over there, they want to include my kids in, but they're not. My kids are over here, and my family is over there.
Yeah. It's the same for us this year. Back in Germany, there's about 3 hours drive between us and the grandparents. We'll have four or five of our relatives coming to see us in August and September. We'll have a full house.
And all of them are.
But that's sad, because they miss out on that. And if you think of most families also in Europe, where the generations sort of separate out, and the little ones don't get the elders, and the elders don't get the little ones, it's very bad for both sides, I think. But it's...
But then your kids have a surrogate family here too. They've got elders in their lives.
Yeah, I know. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they got other people they call uncle and aunties
and Kukum and Mushum.
Grandmother and grandfather.
Which is good too.
Yeah, sure. That's true. And it's good for those elders too to have the little kids around. Good for the parents too. What happened to the interview anyway?
I don't know.
Carried away.
Still, I don't know.
Well, there are other times.
Nothing, but I think the things that I wanted answered, I did get answered. It was the language, the shift between telling and writing. You also said that about the seasons.
Yeah.
So what will come up if you compare that to something that's been published elsewhere or so is that there are many ways, different ways.
I was writing my father, that story my father told me.
Mm-hmm. When about the thunder?
Yeah. I was writing that story. Well, when I started to write it, all kinds of details just coming up.
Mm-hmm.
Details that I don't tell orally, but in written, all these details coming out, even the thoughts of that man, the
mm-hmm.
conversations,
mm-hmm.
all kinds of stuff.
Do you find that if you write it,
it's different?
It gets more detailed.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
It's really different.
Well, that's when I teach about writing, that's what I talk about, that like writing originally was from oral stories, mm-hmm. and what writing has now given is that new dimension of time and space.
Mm-hmm.
And so
mm-hmm.
I can see where that would happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And also you don't get it all on paper. You can't go, it was over there.
Yeah.
You can't do that
no.
on the page. So you've got to give the detail.
Yeah.
It's true. I was writing a long poem in my mind last night.
Telling me, sitting around, you're telling a story, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And this guy is going hunting and you see something over there, eh? I see mm-hmm. over there.
Mm-hmm.
It's over there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of dark light, eh?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You can't do that.
No.
You can't do that on. You write that, wherever that is, you have to...
Yeah, and then he raised his hand and squinted his eyes and pointed in this direction, and you've got to... Sure.
And whatever he sees, that's what... whatever that person sees, you have to write that, too. Different.
That's how my middle daughter got her name from that story that he told about.
Her name is?
It's Uriel Tsekwi, which means Thunder Woman.
Oh,
or actually... It's broader than Thunder Woman. It's like Thunderstorm Woman.
Mm-hmm.
She got mad at me yesterday. Someone said, well, what does it mean? I said, it's Thunderstorm. Well, you keep changing it. You told me Thunder. Now you say Thunderstorm. And I said, because how do I translate it? I said, in English, it's so hard to... If I told them Thunderstorm Woman, they wouldn't understand.
Yeah.
Thunder Woman in English, but it's broader than that in Dene.
Yeah,
she's going, oh.
Mm-hmm.
They say there's four strong medicine people up in our area. At Thunder, Ekor was one of them. Erikal was another one, and there's two other ones there. They all lived about the same time.
The Chanti, right?
Chanti, and then there was another one.
It's been something, right?
My dad told me there was four of them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's never been that. I don't think anybody knows about it, you know. But if you're going to go further down, say Sioux,
mm-hmm.
Sioux Indians,
mm-hmm.
all kinds of things have been written about Sioux, even great medicine men
sure.
and all that, and sacred places and everything.
Mm-hmm.
It's all written on there. But up there, there's nothing.
There's a lot about the Sioux, there's a lot about the Iroquois, and a lot about the Hopi and also the Navajo.
Oh, yeah.
I think the Hopi actually is the most.
The most, yeah.
Incredible how much there's been written on Hopi.
Yeah. I've read some stuff on Iroquois.
Mm-hmm.
But when I was living there with the Iroquois people.
You were at Onondaga.
Yeah, in Onondaga. What I heard then was different from what I read.
Oh, yeah.
I read, almost the same thing, but
mm-hmm.
it's not, but yeah. the oral
yeah.
world part of it, you know, was
yeah.
different,
yeah.
more stronger. You know,
mm-hmm.
way,
mm-hmm.
They talk about a handsome lake.
Yeah.
There's the handsome lake is controversial even even today among the Iroquois people. some people take up a handsome dick, some people are against
yeah.
a handsome lake. They call them handsome lake. You don't know about handsome lake?
Yeah. Was,
I'll tell you about one of these days, handsome lake. Something in your eye.
I looked at the wrong man.
What kind of man is that?
Is that when you get something in your
yeah.
eye?
Oh. So watch Ruth's eyes.
There's a black bird.
Nice, she can talk to him. Tell him you want to go talk to this guy.
So what it's like to be the wife of a storyteller was a witch traveling around. I was going to ask you that, and then you said, that's why I asked Peter, are you traveling around because you're a storyteller?
No.
And you said no, so.
Well, not yet. Not yet. I think it might catch on Nepal. Mm-hmm.
Do people, when you get home or so, do they know you tell stories
no.
down here?
Oh. When I was home, nobody even noticed me,
mm-hmm.
except maybe there's some just half and half.
Mm-hmm.
I was just another
mm-hmm.
person that was
sure.
away from home for a long
no,
time.
I
was not anybody important.
Yeah.
And I come back here, it's like I'm kind of like a celebrity. So I don't know. No, I don't know about that celebrity thing. As long as there's money in there. See, I don't have a job, eh?
No, sure.
I need money to live.
Mm-hmm.
No. You don't have money, you can't eat.
Right.
Money is not important, but it's important
to survive.
Yeah.
So I better go mark papers and make money.
Okay.
What's well, I need some money.
You would like to?
I gotta take up. Well, I'm not in a hurry yet, but.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. What do we need?
I don't know, you tell me.
I don't know your office number.